So you want to be an entrepreneur in something using tech, or maybe you're interested in tech product management. Should you get an MBA? Is it a waste of time and money that you could better spend learning on your own? Founding your own business? Let's hear what these two Stanford GSB grads have to say with the perspective of 7 years of successful entrepreneurial experience since they earned their MBA.
Welcome to Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. Your host is Accepted's founder and world-renowned admissions guru, Linda Abraham. At Accepted, our mission is to get you to that unforgettable moment when you read your acceptance email and shout, "Yes, I'm in!" Confident you'll be attending the perfect program to help you launch the career of your dreams.
Hello and welcome. Thanks for joining me for this, the 382nd episode of Admission Straight Talk. Thanks for tuning in. Before we get to our guests and the interview, I want to let you know that you are invited to Accepted's next MBA Ask Me Anything with Columbia's Michael Robinson, Associate Director of MBA Admissions at Columbia Business School, which is happening tomorrow, September 9th at 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific. If you have questions about Columbia Business School's program or application process, this is your chance to get the inside scoop. What is CBS looking for in its essays? How is it adapting to COVID restrictions? What is it doing to support international applicants and students? Register ASAP to reserve your spot at accepted.com/382-ASKME-ANYTHING or AMA. Again, it's accepted.com/382-AMA. I'd like to welcome back to Admission Straight Talk, Nick Henriksen and Chris Coleman, who were previously guests on Admission Straight Talk in episode 88, a little over 5 years ago. Both Nick and Chris graduated from Stanford GSB in 2013. While at GSB, they founded Carlypso, which was acquired by Carvana in 2017. Let's catch up with them. Nick and Chris, welcome back to Admission Straight Talk.
Thanks, Linda.
Thanks for having us.
Now, when we last spoke, you both had recently graduated from Stanford GSB, and you were running Carlypso, which you had founded as Stanford MBA students. I'm going to link to that episode from the show notes, so listeners can simply go there, it's accepted.com/88, to learn more about the founding of Carlypso and hear a great story about a $50,000 cup of coffee. But what's happened since then? Can you bring us up to date? And let's see, Chris, why don't you start?
Sure. I mean, a lot's happened since then. So I think when we talked, we had sort of, I think we just were going through Y Combinator last. And so we actually ended up pivoting the business into a new model since that time. And so Carlypso was this sort of peer-to-peer car sales platform. We ended up pivoting to being a direct from wholesale channel where we sold cars effectively to these leasing companies that can't sell direct to consumer, but have to sell through these wholesale auctions. And so we became almost a virtual dealer of sorts where we built software that went through and said, okay, what are the cars that we think are good for consumers? How do we figure out how to sort of use performance marketing to our advantage so that we can market the right car to the right consumer? And we had got a pretty good handle on that. It was a good business. It wasn't a great business because it required very, very heavy operations. Like, you know, you're actually moving around 4,000 pound pieces of metal all the time, rather than bits and bytes. And so we ended up finding that the software that we built ended up being more valuable than our sort of end value prop to consumers. And so we sold the software to Carvana and ended up joining as executives there, where Nick ran the sort of sell to Carvana business of buying cars from consumers. And I ran product for the initial part of the consumer experience. So from homepage, search page, and product pages. And then we spent 3 years there. It was a great 3 years of seeing the company go from sort of early public company to, you know, the company everyone else is aiming to beat. And so that was a really fun ride. And we got to know some of the executives there very well, who were super helpful, just very different skill sets than us. And now we've gone off to start a new thing again. And so me and Nick have just started with Clutch, which is sort of a platform for saving consumers on their automotive expenses.
All right. Nick, do you want to add anything to that?
No, it was a bumpy ride. Like, Chris made it sound super straightforward.
Yeah, it sounds very smooth.
Yeah. I mean, when you look backwards, it all went in a sequence.
No, what was really interesting is a couple of things. Our first employee at Carlypso ended up applying to business school when we sold. So business school plays lots of roles in our lives. The person at Carvana who we touched base with to quote unquote compare notes. What we really wanted is sell the company. It happened to be one of our classmates from GSB, and I had worked on a student run event with her, and Chris had gone on a student trip with her. And so thankfully, like GSB reappeared in our lives multiple times. And I don't think we would have made it to where we are without our experience at the GSB, frankly.
Wow. That actually anticipates my next question, which is you earned your MBA in 2013. I don't know if you're at the time, obviously you were in Silicon Valley. I don't know if you are currently, but Silicon Valley is a geography that tends to disparage the MBA. And at the time when we spoke, you were very happy you did your MBA. Do you still think the time you spent at GSB was time well spent, Nick?
There's so many dimensions to it. If you go into it thinking it's an academic experience, you'll walk out of it with so much more than just what you've learned. Both Chris and I, we have a very tight overlapping circle of friends. Most of our friends are GSB students. We're both still in the Bay Area. Chris is in Half Moon Bay. I'm in San Francisco. Yeah, most of our friends in the Bay Area are GSB students. The references for the investors who invested in our new company were classmates and GSB students. And in fact, the partner who led the round said, I'm so surprised that we haven't met before because we have so many friends in common, all of them, believe it or not, GSB students. So yeah, we can't get rid of it.
And what about you, Chris? You anything to add to that one?
Yeah, I think so. Like, I think it's more indirect. Like, A, I think the like mindset of Silicon Valley scorning MBAs is probably less so now than it was. Like, I think there was a time period where, you know, you had some founders who then had companies that were taken over by sort of experienced managers. And I think that's less true today than it was previously. And so I feel like it's not as much a stigma of like evil business person. And then too, I think the benefits of the MBA have been more tangential than like purely direct too. And so like, I think the main benefit was Stanford and GSB was just a way to get a lot of smart, ambitious people together. And then suddenly you form a social group of smart, ambitious people. And so like a lot of the things you learn are totally indirect around, for me, I was the one interested in cars, and I think that's how Nikki learned the dimension of that space here. And the same can be said true of like, we had classmates who were just super into, you know, enterprise software investing. And that's how we got to learn about that side of the business and get some shared enthusiasm there. And so I'm not sure I remember anything from classes I took, but I don't think that was the important part anyway.
Certainly both your comments are focused very much more on the social interactions and the network that you acquired through GSB.
Yeah. I think network to me is like a little bit of a dirty word, because like network implies you like go there with the intention of like having a professional cohort.
Right.
And the truth is you just made
it's almost exploitative.
Right. Yeah. Like it was your network is people that you're friends with. That's sort of how it was formed. Yeah.
A good example is, this is super recent. We left Carvana. Chris, two friends of ours, and I went to tour national parks. One of our friends runs a GSB classmate, runs an angel investment fund. And we asked him for advice. How should we go about fundraising? And he's like, okay, so here's what you should do. Here's the people we need to introduce you to. He has three GSB people who happen to be in those funds, so we have a really easy intro. And so these are all friends now. Like, I wouldn't have asked him. I could have asked him for advice on how to fundraise, even if he has been a stranger. But he's one of our closest friends, and he found so much joy helping his friends. And then he asked us for help, or hopefully will one day, and we'll gratefully return the favor. It's more like helping your friends than anything else.
Right. It's social relationships.
Yeah.
And I agree with you that network on some level has almost a, well, as I said before, a little bit of an exploitative.
Yeah. You know, I always picture like a sleazy mixer. Like that's like this, right. This is what I picture people say networking. I'm like, I don't want to do that.
somebody, I don't remember who it was. I was talking to somebody or reading something, and they said, your network is the people you want to give to.
Right.
That should be the attitude.
Yeah.
That should be the attitude.
The other thing, like it's easy to forget what you learned. Like I could tell you now that undergrad was worthless because I forgot all the things that I know now that I didn't know before, but I didn't realize that I acquired those skills or learnings there. I think there's a few frameworks Chris and I use all the time when thinking through problems, when starting the company. And I can with full certainty say that we learned it from a few classes. We just remember the professors more than the classes, to be honest.
Right. obviously I got my MBA long before you guys did, and I don't remember formulas at all.
Yeah.
I don't remember details. I do remember frameworks and principles that I'm still using. And that was despite the fact that there were several years where I wasn't in business at all. I was raising my family before I started Accepted. So, you know, there's still that. But were there anything that stands out in your minds as being particularly valuable, either an in-class experience or an extracurricular experience? Nick, you want to start with that one?
Yeah, I think it's the relationships to our lecturers. So mm-hmm. now fast forward, like back then, I was almost starstruck who taught us, and these people would meet for a coffee, including Andy Ratcliffe, who you mentioned, who wrote the first take.
$50,000 cup of coffee, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
And so a number of these professors and lecturers invested in our first round, and we couldn't believe they did that. And now we're raising again, and now the relationship is more of a, like, I'll send them a quick text message. Hey, guys, you want to come in? And so it feels almost like the age gap that was wider has become closer, and I almost feel a little bit like a peer to some of our investors,
yeah.
More than being starstruck. And so that's obviously incredible.
Right. Chris, what would you say? What do you think of looking back on your MBA experience, either in class, out of class, curricular, co-curricular? What do you look as most valuable?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I think, you know, we sought out a lot of advice from a lot of different people throughout that time. And I think what stuck with me most is like, the advice that I forgot or didn't take for granted, but like that I thought was not helpful, is people kind of give you wishy-washy frameworks and like non-concrete things. And I think there's a lot of temptation. Like, we went to our business school professors asking them whether we should or shouldn't do this. And they basically said, well, here's what you should think about and here's what you shouldn't. And I always really appreciated when we went to folks, and this was true of a select few, where they were just like, don't do that. Like, here's the decision and here's how I'm thinking about it. And break my line of reasoning. And like those, I always found those discussions much more helpful. And I always try and frame myself when people ask for advice or when I think through a problem of like, okay, like I have to have a view. And so if I have to have a view, otherwise it's not worthwhile getting any advice. And so if I have to have a view, like what supports this and why would I feel strongly or not strongly against it? And like, what would I have to assume to break it? And so like, I think we found a select few thought partners who were very adamant and just had strong worldviews, even if they were very different.
Right. So
like often we went against that advice and we're like, that was super, super valuable, but here's information I have that you don't. That's one way of thinking that I think I took from business school that I think was super helpful.
Did you ever get pushback? Like, I mean, a lot of times people don't want to give direct advice because they're afraid that the person hearing it won't take it. You know, they'll resent it.
I always find that funny too, because like...
you asked me the question, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I actually think it's the responsibility that people don't want. I think if Chris asked me for advice, or my friends asked me for advice, then I extend my opinion or share my opinion. And then there's a little bit of responsibility with that opinion, because if the person takes the opinion, follows my advice, and I was wrong...
Right.
I think that's why people are sometimes a little wishy-washy.
Right, they end up deferential.
Yeah. Exactly.
That could be too.
And so, yeah, as Chris said, we had funny conversation where like this was not a wishy-washy answer. It was dead center, do not do that. I think it's a bad idea. And then we digested what we heard, had collected more information, decided we were still going to do it. And then that same person said, I respect you for not agreeing with me. And I'm glad we can to agree to disagree and tell me the data you had. And I'll probably understand why you made one or the other decision.
That's a great kind of give and take. That's a wonderful way to go. Now, you've both worked in product management. I think, Chris, maybe you a little bit more, but I think both of you did. And this is an area that is of increasing interest, I think, to today's MBAs. What skills and education should MBAs interested in product management pursue? What qualities should they be trying to develop? Chris, you want to start with this one?
Yeah, I'll start. I hate the title of product manager so much.
Okay.
Let me start there, because it's an ambiguous
Why?
Role. It's very ambiguous. Like, and it means different things to different companies for different purposes. And I think there's an attractiveness to it, because people like envision themselves as like, hey, I'm really crafting the product here and I get to write my Medium article and I found value for these consumers. And like it can vary so much across both the stage and type of company as well. And so like, it can be anything from, if you get a product manager role, it can be as much as like a timekeeper and a process keeper, so more project management than anything else. And so that's one extreme. And the other extreme is like a company founder who's like specifically setting overall direction, or you have very technical PMs who are really just ex-engineers who understand what needs to be done for what purpose within this deep infrastructure. And so like, I think the role is too ambiguous in some ways for people to like say, I aspire to product management and this is interesting. Like, I think people should draw on what attributes they want to take part in. And then I think there's other ways to get directly or indirectly involved in those roles. I always think it's strange when people tell me they really want to do product management and
they don't really know what it is.
Matters a huge amount for whom, at what stage, what do you like about it, and what do you really want to do? And I think some people end up very disenchanted because they sort of picture this company founder type role and they end up in this project management type function. And that can be super frustrating.
They picture, a role with the importance of CEO and the security of a salary.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Then nobody asked the question. I had a laugh because I knew that Chris was going to have a strong reaction.
Okay.
A lot of times a product manager is sold as you're the CEO of a little business within mm-hmm. the business.
Mm-hmm. They have P&L, P&L responsibility.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that was not our experience. That's why we had a strong reaction. You work with engineering, you may have junior product managers, you may have analytics, you may have design, but none of these functions report to you. And so if somebody doesn't do a good job, it's very difficult to push back because you have no means of managing these people. And then all of a sudden, you actually, instead of having a company that's run by like a group of enthusiastic people, has like more of a consultant who asks people for advice and manages like the individual stakeholders, but has no authority to enforce anything.
Yeah.
And so now you could push back and say, well, isn't it a strength of a good leader to get things, pull things together? And I would argue to some extent, yes, but if you don't hire or fire them and you can't even comment on their performance and review, then your role as a product manager is really not very strong.
You know, one of the things I do remember from my days at MBA is that there is supposed to be a correlation between responsibility and authority. I don't know why that stuck with me, but it always did. If you don't have authority, you shouldn't have responsibility.
Right, right.
And if you have responsibility, you better have authority to commensurate it with it.
Right.
So it sounds to me like, at least in some firms, the product manager has a responsibility and doesn't have the authority.
Yeah,
I think that's right.
Very uncomfortable position to be in.
Right. And I think it just varies such a huge amount between companies that when you say you like this role, it'd be like, it's almost like saying I like sports. You're like, okay, well, there's like many sports. And so like,
what like is
badminton
probably,
or sprinting?
A number of our classmates went to the tech giants like Amazon, Facebook, Google. We don't have the experience, so I can't speak to it. I could imagine, though, that within a Facebook, a product management role is much clearer articulated, and they're much more similar from one role to each other to the next one than across multiple companies. So if you're asking somebody within Facebook, explain a product management role to me, I wouldn't be surprised if they were more similar from one to the next than across different companies. And so
right.
I think if you talk to MBAs, being a product manager at Facebook, there's a lot of them there and they're having a good time. So I think that is a good role.
And then they would also be much more specific, Chris,
exactly.
You know, to address your concern, your comment. I know I sometimes have MBA applicants saying, you know, I'll ask them, what's your post-MBA goal? And they'll say marketing. Mm. Well, marketing isn't a function,
right.
Really.
Yeah.
All right? There's brand management, there's advertising, there's customer analytics, there's all kinds of things in marketing.
Right.
But marketing itself, unless you're talking about a very small company, is not really a
right.
function.
It's a catch-all.
You study. Right. It's like, oh, I want to do finance. Well, finance isn't really a function.
Right.
It's something you study. You can be right. a financial analyst. You can go into investment management, asset management. There's all kinds of functions within finance. So it almost sounds like on some level,
it's very
this
similar,
is a little bit along lines of Chris's comment. Now, you've also gotten involved, I think both of you, in investing in startups. And how are you enjoying that work? And we're going to get to what with Clutch in just a second.
Yeah.
But I think you've been invested in different startups, right?
Yeah, so we got a lot of help when we got started, like including this first check. And so now we stumbled and got lucky into a position where financially we can be maybe at a slightly lower order of magnitude, but helpful to other founders too. And so that's what Chris and I enjoy a lot. We have a lot of friends who are starting companies and they need a little push in the beginning because it's all about momentum when you raise money.
Right.
And so that's I think the role we're playing when we raise, when we invest. And so the investments we made are primarily in companies of friends of ours, if that makes sense.
Sure, it does. You have more confidence in people that you know.
A number of them GSB students.
Sure, getting back to that. Now let's turn to With Clutch. That's your own new startup. What is it? Okay, Nick, you want to start with that? What is it?
Yeah, so it's a digital platform to refinance auto loans.
Okay.
And the vision on a larger scale is to build something like Credit Karma for your auto expenses. And okay. So the insight for the business came really 3 to 4 years ago when we were selling used cars.
Mm-hmm.
And we realized a big tension between what customers wanted and asked us for and what would have been good for the business, because customers haggle for the price of a car. But then right. At some point, all of a sudden, they fully trust the car dealer with their financial products. And so 80% of the people who get a car loan get the loan from the dealership. Yet the dealership has very different incentives. If I, as a dealer, can present you a loan that pays you a low interest rate or present you a different loan that pays me a high referral fee, guess what dealers do?
Right.
And so there's insight number one. Insight number two is once you work with customers in the car segment that have challenge credit, so lower credit scores, you see when they make payments that they move a lot. They improve their credit a lot and would qualify for better rates, but nobody helps them. So you don't get, nobody rewards you for making your payments. And so the idea is based on these two insights that nobody really refinances auto loans. And we have a few insights and learned a lot that allows us to build a digital platform to do so.
Got it. Chris, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing to add that was when we came up with this new business, we had actually been thinking about this idea since Carlypso days. And so as we found Carlypso hard to scale, like one of the things we always found odd is like consumers don't trust dealers except for when it comes to financial products. Right. Like, and so you go there and you're like, consumers are super skeptical about the used car. They have all these questions.
I mean,
they're
ignoring the used car salesman is like, it's a
joke, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a archetype of someone you don't trust.
Right.
And yet, as soon as you end up in the room figuring out how to get financing, you realize that like what you did research on is only half the product. And so like all these things are highly marked up. There's an incentive tension that exists between the dealer and the consumer. And we felt it because, you know, we were so beat up on car prices that the only way to make money was to mark up these products. And that's sort of one dimension. The other dimension is just like when you look at like this portfolio effect, where as a business, you do rational things, as a consumer, they kind of make you angry. The same is true of health insurance, or health insurance or life insurance, for example. If you're super healthy and you're exercising and you're doing everything to maintain a healthy lifestyle, and you're in a pool with someone who you know is outside, you know, smoking and sitting on the couch and doing unhealthy behaviors, like in some way you just feel like you're subsidizing that expense. And right. The same is true of these loan portfolios too, where if you make your payments and you're getting 25% interest, as a lender, it makes sense that you have to keep those people together because on sort of day zero, they look the same. But then as a consumer, the behavior is differentiated amongst them. And so you can have this sort of positive selection. And we think there was a real opportunity to like serve these consumers in a way that, you know, helps coach you to get even better and then helps you realize money that you could save. And so it seemed like an interesting opportunity that was just directly in our wheelhouse in a way that was engaging and scalable in a way that refurbishing metal never was.
I was just thinking, and you don't have to move 4,000-pound pieces of metal like you.
Yeah, unless we want to.
We
you repossess them, yeah.
when we had the conversation with this GSB friend I told you about who helped us with fundraising, we walked him through what the business would be like multiple times. He invests in software as a service, enterprise software as a service businesses. And he thinks about it's like, okay, so yeah, it's a little bit like software, just really operational. And we're like, why do you mean operational? It's like, well, there's a process afterwards. You need to fund a loan and stuff like that. And we're like, that's not operation. Operations is a warehouse full of cars. And he's like, oh yeah, I guess you come from a very different place.
Right. Well, you're really going from a tangible to intangible to bits exactly. And bytes and financial products. It's a whole different things. Now, I understand why you're starting with refinancing auto loans, but like, do you see yourselves at some point in the future offering auto loans just for people to come in, like almost like pre-approval for auto loans?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. You know, I think it's really hard to do when the deal is in the sales and finalization loop.
Okay.
And so for us, I think it's been our initial focus is going to be on like essentially swapping out bad loan for good loan. Right. And we can do that as soon as, you know, the day or 3 days after a consumer gets a loan. But, you know, the dealer ends up in the loop in many times and they sort of control all the paperwork to actually get the loan done.
Yeah.
And so if you try and insert yourself in that process, they obviously want to make money. And so they're going to try and exert yourself out of that, exert right. us out of that process. And so I think that's really hard. And a lot of startups have stumbled because it's a good, powerful idea. But ultimately, you don't control the decision that happens in the back room when the deal gets done. And people forget that still 99% of car transactions are done completely offline. Mm-hmm. And so like your ability to control that part of the offline process, you're going to have 99 out of 100 customers drop out.
Even during COVID? Even now?
I'm not sure what the COVID figures are, but it's still very low. Like when people say online sales, like there's very little ability to do it other than these online retailers through Carvana or Vroom.
Okay.
And so there's a guy on a phone and maybe that you consider that online, but it's still very much from it.
Right. And do you have any thoughts about buying out leases or helping?
Yeah, lease buyouts are a very interesting market too. So is transforming car purchases into leases. And so I think there's a number of interesting financial products. It's just we have to start somewhere. And so we're building up this portfolio of what we think consumers find valuable. And so like refinancing is a core way where we think we have a competitive edge and to be valuable. And then the same can be said of the products that go along with a financing deal like warranties or gap insurance. And then we'd eventually partner with auto insurance brokerages as well to find new policies. And then from there, there's even the disposition of the car. So like right now, there's one or two online vendors where you can get a firm online quote for what your car is actually worth. I think that number is only going to go up. And so being able to figure out in the future, and once again, this is like a long way down the road of how do we figure out the full life cycle of car.
The big question is, why do we care? Because we've been in the car space for 7 years. Kristen actually thought we'd start another company and try to get out of the car space. And so if you take a big step back, what you're realizing is through what we're doing, you're putting more money into the consumer's pockets. Like there's people who are stuck in loans, they're overpaying. If they didn't have the loans, they could start saving money and build up wealth. Unfortunately, they're stuck in these loans, and so they're just doubling down and paying these auto loan companies.
Well, they're not really stuck. They just don't have
100% stuck. Yeah, you can't get out.
Well, if you pay it off, if you can refinance it, they're not stuck.
No, exactly. Yeah. So that's what we're saying. But like, this is our part, even if only little, but to address income inequality in some way, because you enable people to get unstuck who otherwise would be stuck. Build wealth slowly but surely, and then not pay 29% of their auto loans for 6 years.
Gosh, I remember talking with somebody once, and he was buying a car. I think it was a new car. He was very, very happy with it, and he did finance it. And he said, "I can afford the payment. That's great. What's the interest rate that you're paying?" He says, "I don't know, and I don't care as long as I can afford the payment."
Yeah, a lot of people that way.
You know, and my sister and I just looked at each other. This was our relative. And my sister and I just looked at each other, and we're like, "Okay." But you know, the likelihood was that he was getting taken.
Yeah. The majority of Americans are like that.
Oh, that way. Yeah.
Oh, I know that. Yeah.
Nobody teaches you that.
No. No, you're right. All right. So this could be a very, very valuable service on a lot of different levels.
But the importance is to make it so easy that you can do it over the phone. And so that's where we feel like we're uniquely positioned.
Now, I visited the website, and obviously we'll link to the website from our show notes at acceptable.com/382.
Just 300 periods later, we're back.
You're right. It's almost exactly 300 episodes.
Yeah.
Okay.
The website is version 1.0. Like, we ran experiments. We're in the process of closing a funding round and then make it look nice and shiny and actually functional. But yeah, if you go there, it'll be a manual experience for us in the background, but we can already help you.
Okay, that's great. This is fascinating. And it really does sound like a tremendous opportunity for many, many borrowers, you know, people who have car loans.
Yeah.
Let's go back to, you know, would-be entrepreneurs. I was going to say would-be product managers, but since Chris is on, I'm not going to do that.
You can mute him and then I'll talk.
It's okay. What advice do you have for applicants or would-be entrepreneurs considering, or even entrepreneurs considering an MBA? Would you encourage it and why?
Let's see. So for me, I could have never gotten into the position of starting a company the way we started it. I just wouldn't be here if it wasn't for my GSB experience. Granted, I came from Germany, so I needed to figure out a way how to come over here, get to know people, understand the ecosystem. And so for an international founder or ambitious person who has ambitions to become a founder in his 20s, I would highly recommend it. The Stanford quote-unquote network or circle of friends is very, very powerful. You end up with amazing friends who open every door you want to have open. So I couldn't imagine it differently for myself. I think it would have been really tough to do the same thing without having a foot in the door. That said, my roommate, she's from South America, and she somewhat had a very similar journey. It's possible. And at the GSB, it's just really interesting because you can find your co-founder, which that's obviously hard sometimes to do. And so you have a little bit of time, you're in a very safe space, you get exposure. It helps you a lot to start the business. So I highly recommend it, but there's other ways.
Okay, great. Chris, what would you advise a would-be entrepreneur?
I think you just have to be deliberate around what the reasons you're doing something are for, right? And so like, mm-hmm. if your end goal is to start a business in the shortest possible time frame, then like the best way to do that is to just start a business. And so like an MBA, like I think people end up like, oh, I need to wait till all the perfect pieces align. It's just not going to happen. And you need to force enough pieces to align to where you can make something happen. And like a lot of learning is almost accidental, right? Like you can be deliberate around maybe 50% at best, but like everything we thought would work at Carlypso didn't work. Right. And so, right. Like the only way we sort of got to something that worked well enough was by doing the thing that didn't work. And so like you kind of have to be open to this process of like creative destruction. And so if you go to like, I would say like for me, going to business school was much more about having a social network on the West Coast and meeting other like-minded ambitious people. I knew that it may not help with the explicit goal of, you know, do these other things. But at the same time, like I didn't have enough confidence to start a business by myself. And so doing it with Nick, like gave me the push to go over the edge. I think it can be a good idea for the right person and for the right reasons, but yeah. Know what those are, or at least have a guess to what they are and then be open to being wrong.
And moving. I mean, I think any business that you didn't think it before March, you certainly think it now, you have to be willing to be flexible and pivot.
Yeah, right. Yeah, a lot. I may have two more thoughts that I think sure. are worth mentioning. So I remember one of the last lectures at Stanford, there was MGE, Managing Growing Enterprises, a class, a typical GSB class where protagonists come in and tell you their entrepreneurial story. This one, he must have been a founder entrepreneur himself, said, you need to understand that you're now about to be post-MBA, have this incredible, very unique like situation and possibility that your plan B is incredible. You can go to almost every tech company that you want to go to. You can become product manager. You can go to consulting. You can go to banking. So you don't need to worry about paying your student loans or having a good lifestyle. What you should worry about is how can you be as impactful as possible? And one way to do that is to start a company. And so if you don't do it now, and if you don't do it, who would do it? And I felt like that resonated with me a lot. And it actually came up recently now that we had this experience with selling our company and a good outcome. Like I'm in this exact same position again where I could stay an employee, but I could also try to have a lot more impact, have disproportionate upside. And my plan B is always going to be there. In fact, Chris actually signed an offer while at business school, and then we started selling our classmates' cars. And then had a conversation with his future employer and said, I have a unique opportunity here to pursue something that I really, I'm really excited about. So he's the perfect example of having this incredible plan B, but then he wanted plan A.
Right. I actually interviewed a professor at Kellogg who did research on the correlation between age and successful entrepreneurs. And his conclusion was, I think the most successful entrepreneurs are in their, I think it was 45.
There we go.
45. So, yeah. you got a few years to go, guys.
But, it takes 10 years to build a business. And when you're young, I think the young ones in their 20s are successful. Their ignorance is a little bit of a bliss. So you just stumbled into something. I think when you, especially a second-time founder, you're a lot more thoughtful around what are the key hypotheses. And I, that might actually help. I could agree with that.
Right. Well, he said one thing is already having entrepreneurial experience increases the likelihood of success. So,
you think so.
You might have had your failures in the 20s, but that was actually what his research said. It was a very interesting, and I'm going to link to it from the show notes, but it was a very interesting episode. But it doesn't mean that nobody can do it. Clearly, you can do it in your 30s, and there are some who've done it in their 20s. But I think, he had you have to have a problem you're going to solve. That was one of the things he said. And clearly, you guys are doing that, both in your previous business to a lesser extent, perhaps, and with Clutch. Now, another question, more on the admissions and MBA kind of question. Would you say to many people, M7 or bust? M7 are the top MBA programs. It's Harvard, Stanford, Wharton, Columbia, Kellogg, Chicago, and sometimes the seventh one sometimes varies. It's usually MIT. But I mean, whether you talk M7 or you talk top 10 or what, top 15, I sometimes say the top 10 has about 15 schools in it. But would you say that, or can you say across the board, top or bust?
I only did one, so it's very hard for me to speak.
Okay.
I think what one sentence I heard a lot of people tell me before I apply it, do your best, but don't be frustrated by the outcome if it's not what you wanted, because the right business school picks the right candidates. And so in our case, I applied and didn't even get interviewed by Harvard, for example. And so that felt like a disappointment during the process. At that time, I didn't know that I was going to get into Stanford. But I personally feel like I'm so much better fit for Stanford, given like this slightly roller coaster like-ish resume of mine, because I tried a lot of things. And if your resume and your background fits best into another business school that's not among the top 10, that doesn't mean your experience will be bad. So I truly think that the business schools and the candidates pick themselves, and every experience will be valuable in some way.
Chris, you have anything to add to that one?
Yeah, I mean, I hate to give this answer, but I think, once again, you just have to be deliberate around what you want out of it. And if you're looking for career advancement and you go to the 38th best business school, expecting to have the same opportunities that someone who just graduated HBS, like, that's not a realistic expectation. And then, you have to factor in, what does it cost you? So, like, if you're paying the same for 38th, your career opportunities aren't as good, that's bad math. And so figure out what you want as post facto, and then go into it eyes wide open, and don't believe whatever school is selling you on. They're trying to get you.
It depends on where you're starting at.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
If you're doing private equity, that 38 school, ranked school, whatever it is probably not going to provide you with any ROI whatsoever.
Right, exactly. I would also say, just like, don't take whatever the school says as gospel either, right? Like, schools are selling you to go there. So have a healthy skepticism.
And talk to alumni. Like, this is, they're just like you, just a few years ahead of you. And if you can imagine yourself being a classmate and friend with that person, then do it. There's nothing wrong with going to a school that's not top 1, 2, 3, 7 or whatever the number is.
It's also helpful to talk to people who got in but didn't go. Like, that's the other helpful audience that people often neglect too, because anyone who's gone, sort of, they don't know how their life would have worked out otherwise, but the people who didn't go know how their life worked out. Right. So that's another healthy audience. Get a holistic view.
Good point. So what are your plans going forward? Chris, you want to start with that one?
Yeah. I mean, right now we're knee deep in this business. So we're at very early stages of product market fit. And so I think this is one of the most fun stages of do everything you can to find a product that consumers love and provide value to them. I think this is the most fun stage of a company, in my opinion. And I tend to be less good at come up with the processes for managing 18 people type thing. And so, I think this is well suited to my skill set and what I'm eager about and a problem I really know well. And so, we're just eager to be heads down a little bit.
Sounds good. Nick?
Similar. I'm a little bit better at the later stage, but I have Chris to be creative. So he tells me his 10 ideas, and I'll tell him, let's start with these two. But I'm somewhat excited about, or nervous, but not in a bad way, is the world is very different now than the last time we ran a company. Like, we had the team in one office. We made with a conscious effort to have engineering and product and service, customer service and success, and the warehouse all in one building. So we were really close to each other and could build culture. That's already panning out to be not the case right now, which downside is building culture is a very conscious and deliberate effort. But the upside is you can work with really talented people from across the world. And I'm looking forward to a lot of conversation we have with people who are not even in the US. So I think that's an interesting one. And then obviously the topic diversity and building really powerful companies that are very inclusive. Also another topic is culture. That's something that was important 5 years ago, but is very much at the surface right now. And so we have a responsibility there, and I'm excited to see how I can contribute.
I think it's possible to build a culture remotely. I mean, Accepted has a culture, and yep. We've been completely remote for a long time.
Ever since, yeah.
Long, long time. It is definitely possible. What would you have liked me to ask you? Nick, you want to start with that one?
Do I know somebody who's trying to apply?
Okay, well, that the answer is very easy to.
It actually is an interesting conversation to have with candidates, whether or not to get help on their essays and telling their story. I remember back then there was a stigma around getting help. I don't know what it is today.
And it's dissipated, people, thank God.
It's good to get help. But like for me, this was like a therapy session. Like, what do you really care about? And so the essay is called What Matters Most to You and Why? And I gave my first draft was very different than the essay I submitted. And I felt like I learned a lot. Yeah. And so I'm giving that advice to applicants who, especially the ones who are not from the US, these are just essays we're not used to writing anywhere else but in the US. And so getting help is just part of the journey.
I don't think Americans are really used to writing them either, actually.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, you have more data than I do.
No. Chris, what would you have liked me to ask you?
I guess like one interesting question for now is like, how do you think the MBA needs to evolve given what you've like, given the experiences you've had and things like that? And so like, I think to some degree too, the curriculum's a little too rigid on these like old school management skills in some way, like you need to learn basics of accounting. You need to learn basics of XYZ. And I think those are like important fundamentals, but I think in other ways, like there's ways to see whether people sort of know enough that they can immerse themselves in like different, very different experiences and explore very different things in like this very finite 2 years. Some of the most useful classes for us were around like these new venture explorations for people who wanted to do startups or to go 10 levels deeper in investment theory. And so like anytime you're doing basic skills that you sort of already know, you're taking away from these more explorative topics. And for me, I wanted to do a little more on computer science. So I took like some computer science classes while I was at Stanford. And I thought that was super interesting too, just to gain like a fundamental understanding. And so I think like being a little more green field with what the curriculum could be rather than like rigid skills requirements is that sort of evolves. Because part of the goal here is just teach people how to teach themselves more so than give them concrete skill sets. And so I think the more you can sort of instill that in the future, the better off you're gonna be with candidates and former students who can actually go ahead and do that.
All right, great. You know, Nick and Chris, I really want to thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. It's been delightful. And I appreciate your sharing your experiences and your perspective and your experience over the last 7 years. It's been wonderful catching up. Where can listeners learn more about With Clutch, your latest venture?
I think the easiest way is just to learn more and check it out is to go to withclutch.com. Alternatively, and this has been happening more and more lately, and I love it, is when people connect with us directly on LinkedIn. Just look for Chris Coleman or Nicholas Hendrickson if you want advice, be it for your application or if you want to refinance your car, we'll help with that too. Yeah, I find LinkedIn has become a very valuable platform, and I'd love feedback. Feedback is a gift. So for whatever reason you want to get in touch, feel free to get in touch.
Okay. We'll link to With Clutch and Nick and Chris's LinkedIn profiles, as well as related podcasts and articles, including the previous interview with Nick and Chris. Find it all at accepted.com/382. And a quick reminder, don't miss tomorrow's Columbia Business School AMA with Michael Robinson. Reserve your seat now by registering at accepted.com/382AMA. Again, that's accepted.com/382AMA. Listener, thank you too for tuning in to this, our 382nd episode. If you are concerned that you missed something in today's show, don't worry. We've taken the notes for you, and you could be out jogging or doing whatever. You'll find the show notes for this episode at accepted.com/382. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.